Our first speaker today is activist scholar Professor William Sells of Seton Hall University, who is the author of Southern Africa, Same Struggle, Same Fight. Let me here commend Professor Sells for his work in serving as one of the principal organizers for this conference. I'll introduce our other two speakers shortly.
Thank you, Ron. Brothers and sisters, I'd like to briefly discuss with you my approach to the legacy of Malcolm X, and it in fact focuses on the period 1963 to 1965, as I see Malcolm as playing a very important role in the process of transition of the civil rights movement to its later black power phase. So my comments are related to a particular aspect of the total Malcolm legacy. Malcolm X is one of two preeminent leadership figures in the African-American social upheaval of the 1950s and 60s. While still in the Nation of Islam, he pushed the development of the civil rights movement forward while yet standing apart and outside of it. The nationalism of the Nation of Islam represented a scathing critique of the established civil rights movement, although it provided little or no guide to anti-racist activism. When that movement entered its period of crisis between 1963 and 65, Malcolm X broke with the Nation of Islam so that he could not only expand its critique of the civil rights movement, but also actively join it in an effort to effect its qualitative transformation from a domestically oriented mobilization focused on civil rights to a movement for human rights with a recognized international personality. He contributed to this transformation by restoring a secular political revolutionary nationalism to the previously assimilationist, integrationist-oriented movement. Moreover, in the last 11 months of his life, he reestablished in that revolutionary nationalism the traditional place of preeminence reserved for Pan-Africanism. This presentation will focus on Malcolm's attempts to resolve the central dilemma facing the civil rights movement in the period 1963-65, and the transition in Malcolm's political thought it required, a transition from the religious nationalism of the Nation of Islam to the political internationalism of his final statements. The civil rights phase of the movement was largely centered in the South, although it enjoyed national and international support. Its objective was the achievement of first-class citizenship through the destruction of state-sanctioned legal segregation and discrimination in the Deep South and the border states. Through the method of nonviolent direct action, crises were created through disruption, which precipitated confrontations between the federal judiciary and executive and the various municipal and state governments in the South. By 1965, federal executive, judicial, and legislative action had delegitimized Jim Crow. This was a historic victory for African Americans and for all humanity, one from which we are still benefiting. Nevertheless, in the period 1963 to 65, the civil rights movement was finding it difficult to effect crucial internal changes related to the institutionalization of formal movement organizations, the transformation of a regional movement into a truly national one, and the integration of previously inactive classes and social strata into the ongoing mobilization. In the wake of notable successes, the movement was threatened with disillusion because it found it difficult to make hard, tactical, and strategic choices between programs of reform or revolution. It confronted a dilemma characteristic of this stage of a movement's development. Reform strategies may limit the ability to broaden the mobilization as leadership and middle-class elements are co-opted, while revolutionary strategies invite repression. This dilemma had to be confronted at a time when critical changes were taking place in several crucial variables affecting the Afro-American social mobilization. Political opportunities had changed with the emergence of the white backlash, the Vietnam War, and the student power movement. Organizational strength was impacted by the dramatic growth in membership and geographic diffusion of the movement. Organizational consensus was lost as the major civil rights leaders disagreed over whether regular access to power had been achieved. Urban inhabitants rebelled violently against ghetto conditions, and the federal government implemented plans to discredit the movement and its more radical leadership. In the same period, the black nationalism of Malcolm X emerged as a major alternative to Dr. King's nonviolent direct action philosophy. Upon his break with the Nation of Islam, Malcolm was able to reformulate the secular political nationalism which is deeply embedded in the African-American radical tradition. Because of Malcolm X and the social forces which thrust him into leadership, Afro-American nationalism emerged as a major ideological force in the civil rights movement. It offered a plan of action to transcend the dilemma of co-optation and repression associated with the tactical and strategic choices between programs of reform or revolution. Malcolm X makes several qualitatively distinct interventions in this crisis period of 1963-65. First, while still in the Nation of Islam, Malcolm develops a scathing critique of the established civil rights movement. Second, he extracts the rational kernel of Afro-American nationalism from the millenarian messianism of the Nation of Islam. By so doing, he fashioned the nationalist mood of the insurgent black workers and street people into a coherent ideology focused on revolution, not reform. Lastly, by giving the Afro-American people an international personality, Malcolm X hoped to vastly improve its alliance potential with revolutionary forces abroad and thus to neutralize the tremendous repressive capabilities of the American state. In criticizing the civil rights leadership, Malcolm X focused on three crucial aspects of that movement: ideology, leadership, and organization. At the level of ideology, Malcolm indicted the civil rights movement as suffering from false consciousness, as defining the goals and objectives of the movement as the integration of black people into the American system. It projected no fundamental critique of American society and erred by restricting its definition of the problem as one of civil rights and their achievement through nonviolent direct action. Thus defined as a domestic concern of the United States, African Americans were constrained to view themselves as an isolated minority, ultimately dependent on the goodwill of those who have oppressed them. It refused to acknowledge the peoplehood of the African American, preferring instead to emphasize those attributes which confirm its, quote, Americanness, end quote. So conceived, the movement of African Americans was isolated from the broad sweep of change that was convulsing the world, ending white world supremacy and ushering in the era of Afro-Asian hegemony. In addition, the exclusive focus on nonviolence as the guiding philosophy of the movement removed from serious consideration other tactics and strategies which had proved effective in nullifying the overwhelming military technological might of the imperialists. This desire to integrate with a fundamentally faulty and wicked system, Malcolm argued, flowed from the nature of civil rights leadership. This leadership was in the tradition of the House Negro slavery days. Its political frame of reference was defined by the needs and desires of the master, and its cultural values were those of the master's culture. The middle-class civil rights leadership, by following in the nonviolent assimilationist tradition of its House Negro forebears, had embarrassed the race and sold out the masses of black people. Organizationally, the civil rights movement had created no real space within it for the urban working poor and lumpen street people, and it did not represent their interests. It had created no organizational forms for collective self-defense. Just as significant, the assimilationist middle-class leadership made no attempt to forge organizational links with the pan-Africanist and anti-imperialist forces in the international arena. Late in 1963 and into the spring of 1964, before leaving for Africa, Malcolm labors rediscover the African-American secular tradition of political nationalism. At the level of ideology, Malcolm X defined the African-American nationalist tradition as a revolutionary one, a violent struggle for land and self-determination. He saw African-American nationalism as an integral part of the worldwide revolution of Afro-Asians against white domination. Even as early as his message to the grassroots speech given before suspension from the Nation of Islam, Malcolm X essentially saw black nationalism in international perspective. And I'll quote him briefly when he said, "He, the white man, knows that the black revolution is worldwide in scope and in nature. The black revolution is sweeping Asia, is sweeping Africa, is rearing its head in Latin America. All the revolutions that are going on in Asia and Africa today are based on what? Black nationalism. A revolutionary is a black nationalist. He wants a nation." In the same speech, Malcolm X attacked the concept of a nonviolent revolution as a phenomenon not confirmed by the facts of contemporary history. After reviewing the various anti-colonial uprisings, Malcolm X said, and I quote briefly again, "I cite these various revolutions, brothers and sisters, to show you that you don't have a peaceful revolution. You don't have a turn the other cheek revolution. There's no such thing as a nonviolent revolution. For Malcolm X, black nationalism was the natural political expression of the field nigger tradition in African-American political culture. This field nigger tradition is predicated on a profound hatred of the slave master and all his works. As well, it is oriented to the destruction of slavery by any means necessary. In no way does it identify with the values of the slaveholder, valuing only those things which contribute to the destruction of the slave master and his hated institution. The resurrection of the field nigger mentality in the contemporary Negro of Malcolm's day required a psychological rapprochement with Africa. From this identification of African-American nationalism as the natural political expression of the masses of dispossessed urban African-Americans, Malcolm asserts that the only valid movement leadership is that which is indigenous to and therefore able to establish rapport with the black urban working classes and the urban street people. On the other hand, legitimate leadership in the black community had to have established credentials in international forum and the respect of third world leadership. Later, on the question of leadership, Malcolm, under the influence of revolutionary thinking in Africa and the third world, moved away from a messianic conception of leadership to one more grounded in the collective equality typical of the revolutionary cadre organizations in the liberation movements. From Cairo in July and August of 1964, Malcolm wrote home to his associates not to confer upon him any special preeminent role in organizational decision-making. One of his most important tasks was to establish collective democratic decision-making in the OAAU and reverse the legacy of authoritarian leadership carried over from the Nation of Islam period. Upon leaving the Nation of Islam, Malcolm X averred that the basic principle of nationalist organization was that black people had to control the institutions and leadership in their communities. This was to be achieved under the rubric of black economic nationalism and the pursuit of power in the electoral arena through independent black political institutions. As a result of his two trips to Africa in 1964, Malcolm X developed a better understanding of the impossibility of the coexistence of black control of black communities in a monopoly capitalist economy rooted in Western imperialism. His growing appreciation of capitalism as a bloodsucker forced upon him an appreciation of the limits of black economic nationalism. It was in this sense that by January of 1965, Malcolm X felt that black nationalism no longer accurately described his thinking. It was not that he had ceased to be a nationalist, but that his nationalism had distanced itself even more from the reactionary aspects of black economic nationalism which he had inherited from the Nation of Islam. Malcolm X was a revolutionary nationalist to the end, but a growing appreciation of imperialism even more rooted Malcolm's thought in an anti-imperialist, internationalist, pan-Africanist perspective. This perspective identified the first order of business in establishing an African-American liberation movement as giving serious consideration to organizational forms which would facilitate collective self-defense up to and including guerrilla warfare if necessary. In addition, it sensitized Malcolm to the need to seriously explore an alternative to capitalism. He looked closely and favorably on African nationalist attempts to create an African socialism. At his death, however, he had not established clearly what kind of socialism should supersede capitalism. There is no available information that Malcolm X had affirmed a commitment to scientific socialism or communism. By 1965, however, he had certainly shed any previous anti-communism that might have been attributed to him from his Nation of Islam period. His intervention in the civil rights movement most certainly cleared the way for the emergence of the serious study of Marxism-Leninism, which appeared in the later 60s and early 70s in organizations like the Black Panther Party, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, and the African Liberation Support Committee. While still in the Nation of Islam, Malcolm already articulated a strategy of indicting the United States for violations of the human rights of African Americans under international law. The attractiveness of this possibility of mobilizing internationally based forces to check the domestic racism of the United States was to push Malcolm X through thought and action increasingly into the international arena, while at the same time effecting significant modifications in that thought. Malcolm X visualized the OAAU as the organizational vehicle for internationalizing the struggle of the Afro-American. Such an internationalization of the civil rights struggle, he felt, was absolutely essential if we were to have any chance of success. As he put it, and I'll quote him briefly again, Malcolm said, "I would like to impress upon every Afro-American leader that there is no kind of action in this country that is ever going to bear fruit unless that action is tied in with the overall international struggle," end quote. Internationalism would, in Malcolm's view, transmute the Afro-American's minority status in white America into a majority status within the worldwide majority of black people. Organizationally and politically, Malcolm saw the United Nations and the Bandung Third World Bloc as a counterweight to the domestic political power of the United States. Internationalization of the struggle meant to transform the struggle from civil rights into a struggle for human rights. The advantage here is that the United Nations Charter, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and the Genocide Convention unequivocally affirm the paramountcy of human rights, whereas domestic United States law was still quite imperfect guarantor of the civil rights of Afro-Americans. If successful, the internationalizing of the struggle of Afro-Americans would give blacks breathing room in relation to the power of racism in the United States due to U.S. fear of world opinion. Such breathing room could be used to organize for self-defense, aggressive electoral politics, and black economic advancement. Malcolm X repeatedly returns to the theme of self-defense because he truly believed that Afro-Americans would have to fight their oppressors because, and I quote him again, "violence is the only language they understand. And Afro-Americans needed allies internationally, especially in Africa, if they were going to have to fight." Malcolm X feared the intentions of American white people. But in the OAAU period, Malcolm X goes to great lengths to establish a material basis for his animosity toward whites. This he had to do because some of the most nationalistic and radical regimes on the African continent were also the most anti-racist. He would not have been taken seriously by the likes of Nyerere and Nkrumah if he had not repudiated the Muslim devil theory of whites or any veiled equivalents of it. The OAAU as a united front was patterned upon and reflected the structure of the mass-based nationalist parties which led countries like Ghana, Guinea, Tanzania, and Kenya, among others, to independence. The OAAU concept also reflected the impact that revolutionary organizations in the Portuguese colonies and southern Africa and the Algerian revolutionary experience had on Malcolm. On a more practical level, the OAAU would facilitate the granting of United Nations observer status to Malcolm X's organizational efforts and make it easier for Malcolm to address his international audience as a legitimate representative of a national liberation movement. In summary, we can see that in the period between late 1962 and the summer of 64, Malcolm X articulated a political philosophy which addressed the dilemma which faced the civil rights movement in the 1963-65 period. This dilemma, the contradiction between reform succumbing to co-optation and revolution succumbing to repression, was resolved in Malcolm X's thought through recourse to a secularized and internationalized Pan-African nationalism. This ideology addressed co-optation by recognizing that different strata of the black middle class had different revolutionary potential. It also recognized that for all strata of the middle class, the process of co-optation was uneven, vacillating between co-optation and repulsion. The advocacy of a sense of racial mission and a paramountcy of the needs of the race over individual needs have been themes which historically appealed to the more nationalistic segments of the black middle class, as well as to its intelligentsia. Malcolm X made a home in the ideology of revolutionary black nationalism for this strata of the black middle class. As well, his continued advocacy of community self-sufficiency and development created a space and an outlet for the talents of those black middle class entrepreneurs who were not or could not be co-opted. Malcolm's insistence on the centrality of Africa in the black psyche forced the civil rights movement to confront the question of black identity. Such a confrontation and resolution was essential to transforming a nationwide black community, which heretofore had been a numerical expression of people who happened to be black, into a united force for change in America. As well, this question of identity made a space for the black masses to articulate their agenda and to aspire to leadership positions. This was so because so much of what was African or black about the community was tied up with the culture of the black proletariat. Traditionally, the middle class assimilationist impulse and aversion to Africa were most clearly manifest in a rejection of the validity of black working class culture and its potential for effecting social change. From the tradition of Afro-American revolutionary nationalism, Malcolm X injected into the civil rights movement the notion of facing up to violence and organizing to fight back by any means necessary. In this tradition, there was always a sense that physical resistance was possible for the Afro-American in the United States because he was part of a larger international community of color, which possessed the potential for neutralizing the might of racism in America. In its Pan-African formulation, this revolutionary nationalist tradition had always emphasized the unity of the struggles of Africans in the continental homeland and in the diaspora. It always pointed directly to the alliance between Pan-Africanists and all other peoples of color in international forums and institutions. Here, the thought of Malcolm X held out hope that the international prestige of the Afro-American struggle might stay the hand of repression if the revolutionary alternative had to be resorted to. Malcolm X was finally able to extricate black nationalism from the cul-de-sac which the Nation of Islam's position on white people had led it. He recognized, as most of the historical black nationalist leadership, that the racial sense of mission bound up in the notion of Ethiopianism was a mission on behalf of all mankind, a humanist mission. Thus, he was able to redefine separatism into social transformation here in the Western Hemisphere and Europe, and as well, by so doing, define a role for those whites seeking a new relationship with the black revolution. Malcolm X stood the test of time as a thinker and critic of the black intellectual tradition. It is through Malcolm that the black liberation movement was taught many of the principles undergirding revolutionary movements throughout the Third World. Malcolm represented an important transition between King's Gandhian nonviolence and the redemptive violence of Fanon. Malcolm X is just as directly linked to the salient thought of an Amilcar Cabral or even a Mao Zedong. In his thought and in his living example, Malcolm told no lies and claimed no easy victories. He was a thinker with a scientific outlook who neither retreated from calling a spade, nor avoided the necessity of giving presence to the struggle against their own weaknesses. Most important, through Malcolm, more and more ordinary black people are able to transcend the particularity of their oppression and begin to visualize their day-to-day struggle as a local, particular aspect of the more general international struggle for human rights, a revolutionary movement which is essentially a political struggle for power. Thank you.